Holden Forum is a kind of unique place in Holden's history, in that everyone is encouraged to express his or her opinion regardless of whether there's any basis for it. So we don't claim to be experts. I've only been working on these problems really for 112 days since I got here. Kevin has been working on it much longer and has thought a great deal about it, and I can guarantee you has some real positions. He's worked with the Greenpeace movement, and he's interested in housing, low-cost housing.
Kirk.
Low-cost housing for all kinds of people.
And
Julian from Canada, I guess you're from Canada, at least you're at the University of British Columbia, studying resource management, has been working on these issues for a long time. And Doug has got a degree in electrical engineering and works for the power company. So he's part of the problem.
We'll see.
At any rate, I think he's a sheep in wolf's clothing. Now, Mark's going to start us off, Mark, with a little bit of music. Mark Olson.
Are we thinking small or thinking
Ozone,
large?
Ozone.
We're thinking large.
Thinking large. He's got a song in garbage, too. He's just written.
I write a lot of garbage. Some of you know this song. It's the Ozone Layer song. If you know it, feel free to sing along. I'll try and project my voice over the guitar.
Sorry, my friend, but you don't have a prayer. We, you see, are the human race. Just spread our garbage all over the place. Oh, the rare. I'm sorry, my friend, but you don't have a prayer. I guess we like using styrofoam cups and aerosol hairsprays just too much. Let our coffee get cold or our hair go flat.
A little bit negative. I have here a magazine called Reason, and says the greenhouse effect is real, but that's no reason to throw out industrial civilization. It says that if there is warming, unlike a flood, hurricane, or earthquake, the sea level rise wouldn't occur suddenly. It would happen over centuries, not over days, giving humanity time to adapt. And so the first question we really face, is this the situation that we have centuries to adapt, or is there a crisis? So, panel, who wants to go first?
I don't think we do. We don't have centuries to adapt. In some aspects of the global warming, we might. It's not really determined yet what's happening on that front. There's difference of opinion. It may take decades, it may take centuries, but we're not just confronted with one crisis called global warming. We're confronted with the whole breakdown of our ecosphere in several fronts. Ozone layer, the building up of toxic residues planet-wide through agriculture, through industrial pollutants. So I don't think we have centuries to just sort of kick back and maintain status quo.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think that from the people that I I'm studying with at UBC, there's a number of people that are involved in some of the global models for greenhouse effect, and there's a lot of difference of opinion amongst the various groups around the world that are trying to model the greenhouse effect with computers and very complex mathematical models. There's a number of weaknesses in those models. One is they don't include clouds at all. So we're still guessing about what the real effect is going to be. If global warming does occur, there may be some more moisture thrown up into the atmosphere, which creates a cloud bank which protects us. It may have the opposite effect and create more of a blanket. So we're really guessing still. Secondly, although none of the groups totally agree, they're using different areas for their studies and different regions of the world and different parts of the circulation models. They all agree at about a 75% confidence level that global warming is already occurring. So 3 in 4 chance it's already happening. They do not agree at what is the sort of scientific norm, which is 95%, or even 99%. So what these guys are saying, and they're mostly men, is that they're willing to gamble that 1 in 4 chance it isn't happening.
It isn't
happening. In a 3 in 4 chance, they say it is happening. Some of the groups are saying at a 95% confidence level it is happening too. There's a group in Washington which came out with the most conservative study and said, well, it's not happening, we don't have to worry, it's a little sort of perturbation on the ground. And they used basically a region just around Washington, and not Washington State, Washington DC, and used a time scale of about 10 years. There are other groups that have tried to use whole of continents over many more years. So the scientists don't agree, and they have a very, very stringent line. I'm not a gambler, I don't want to live with a 1 in 4 chance. I'm far happier to go with a 3 in 4 chance, or even a 50% chance, or even a 1 in 10 chance that it might be happening. I don't think we can afford to gamble. If global warming starts to occur, some people have said, well, it's fine, we just get warmer temperatures, we'll all be happier, there's more crops, we can grow kiwi fruit in the West Coast. The fact is that the soils won't move. The ecosystems won't adapt that fast. These changes are going to happen really very rapidly. Bangladesh will be underwater within a couple of years if the gradient of the change is as predicted. It's a really very, very striking change. If change did occur over the kind of long timescale that some of the people are suggesting, I think we have even less hope. I have a little story I was telling some of these other people earlier on about the frog in the pan syndrome. And the idea is that if you put a frog in a cold pan of water and heat it up very slowly, the frog will not jump out of the pan because it just doesn't realize there's a change. Just the very slow incremental change, it will never perceive that. It doesn't leap out, so it stays there until it boils to death. If you put a frog in a pan when it's warm, of course it jumps straight out again. We're like the frogs in the pan. There is this change occurring and it's accelerating. There are many, many indicators. I can list a whole bunch of indicators of not only just global warming that are occurring and are going into major positive feedback, so that the ecosystems are breaking down and are accelerating in that breakdown. And I actually don't think that we are now in a position to stop that. I think we can temper it, but I'm very, very scared. I think the greenhouse effect is happening, and I think that we have to do something very, very quickly.
From the point of view of producing electrical power, global warming, whether it's a 50% chance or a 25% chance or a 75% chance, just adds to the reasons for cutting down on the production of especially coal-fired power, which does a lot of other things besides add CO2 to the atmosphere. Also provides a source of acid rain, and the utilities in the United States are looking at, within the next few years, a lot of them are going to be needing more power due to the growth of electrical use. And so and it's very expensive to produce coal-fired and nuclear-fired electricity. So we see global warming regardless of what its chances of occurring, as just adding another reason to make our society more energy efficient. And I like to use the sieve analogy. Right now, many of the utilities on a nationwide basis, they give the running short of power, don't have enough for our industrial growth, so the solution is to produce more power plants. Well, I call this pouring more water into a sieve that's just leaking electricity like mad, leaking water like mad. The solution that I propose and to work with my own utility is you block up the sieve first so you don't need to pour in as much electricity and water in the first place. So from the power production point of view, global warming just adds another reason for us to get on the stick, and some utilities, I think, are trying to show some leadership to getting the society more energy efficient, to not be wasteful. What good does waste add to the society? Waste has no value. So that's a kind of perspective from.
But this isn't really going to affect us, is it? I mean, those of us who are alive today, it'll be our children or our grandchildren.
No, I think it's going to affect us very, very dramatically. Again, the predictions that some of the immediate effects that are happening. Again, one of my supervisors just came back from Moscow, where he was in a circumpolar conference, and one of the biggest problems they're dealing with in the Arctic now is something called Arctic haze. And that's where toxins that are carried in the air are brought up to the polar regions by circulation and collect there, and it condense in the cold temperatures and fall onto the snowpack. And of course, then get into the water and then immediately into the food chain. And we're already seeing that the PCB levels in fish are so high that the Innu and the Inuit people who live in those regions can't eat their standard diet. In fact, they can't eat more than one small fish a day without exceeding their level of toxins that they should be taking in. So these things aren't sort of happening in the next 10 years or the next 50 years, they're happening right now. And we can't get rid of that stuff. We can't take out those toxins from the snowpack, they're there. Moreover, if global warming occurs, the whole of the polar regions, the permafrost, is trapping in methane within those tundra regions. Now if that melts, we're going to release this enormous amount of methane into the atmosphere. And that accelerates again this whole process. So everything we're doing is accelerating the change.
What does methane do?
Methane is one of the gases that contributes to forming a layer around the globe, so that you have heat coming in from the sun and then it's reflected back and re-radiated out from the Earth at a different wavelength, which is trapped within that layer. It's just like a greenhouse, it works exactly the same way. So the more of this gas we contribute, the worse the problem gets. And if you look at the sort of graphs of change, they're just all going exponential. The predictions that people like David Suzuki, who's one of the leading people in Canada, are bringing forward, are 10 to 15 years. And that scares me a great deal. It's not my children, it's me. And it's
what's
everybody.
What's going to happen in 10 to 15 years?
We will have reached the stage in the natural ecosystem where the positive feedback effects have gone out of control. And that there'll be so many lost species, there'll be so much breakdown the relationships and the linkages in our ecosystems.
You're talking about the absorption ability of the ecosphere to take in these,
sure,
the heat, the toxins, whatever, and still function.
But
those things.
But also other
down.
Knock-on effects. I mean, we talked the other day about bees who, bees see in one particular band of the spectrum, and a slight shift in that, and bees will be blind. So we're not going to have any pollination. So I mean, the crop is going to fail. You know, we're going to have all these effects start knocking on. Each little change, small change, it might be in one small space.
And what we'll call a beast, what causes the bees to go blind?
An increase in UV, increase in ultraviolet light.
And that's due to?
That's through the ozone.
That the ozone is being depleted.
Yeah. There are so many of these things that are feeding on each other.
So I heard you say we had 15 years.
Well, that's the figure that's been bandied around at the moment. Amongst the people I'm working with, it may be a very pessimistic one. It may
be. We have any? What do you all think about what's happening to us? Is it happening?
Why is not more attention being paid then by political bodies, by
media. You're the last country in the world.
I beg your pardon?
You're the last country in the world to take note. The
United States is real slow.
I think part of it has to do with the Reagan philosophy of deregulation. I mean, that the Environmental Protection Agency budgets were just shredded under Reagan, and that's, you know, our front line of effort was.
The Reagan era fed a mentality of let's continue the way things have always been. We've always been manifest destiny. You know, let's consume more. We're a consumer society, and things are just like they are back in the good old days. And that is carried
the deregulation,
through.
I mean, carried we don't
through.
Need,
you know,
looking at problems of a global magnitude, I mean, that's where you need, where individual efforts will, sure, they'll do something, but where you need the whole world working together.
Sure.
Yeah, the thing is, the U.S. has been one of those outliers.
I guess the beginning of the real surge, there was a conference in 1974 in Stockholm, which was the beginning of the realization that something really had to change. And it was in 1980 that something called the World Conservation Strategy was published by the IUCN in Geneva. And then nothing really happened following that until 1987, when a book called Our Common Future was published. And Gro Harlem Brundtland, the Prime Minister of Norway, headed up a committee which produced that report. And it was the first book that really synthesized all this stuff and said, hey, there's a real problem. America, the United States, didn't pick up that book at all. In fact, the first hearings on sustainable development, which is something we should talk about, but on that theme, didn't happen until this fall. At that conference, President Carter was there and was making some extraordinary statements, such as, all development aid for the United States should be humanitarian aid, untied completely. William Colby, the ex-head of the CIA, was saying that there is no longer a national security problem, there is a natural security problem. Mm-hmm. And that arms, this is William Colby, right, the guy we all know about, and he suggested cutting the military budget in half and putting all that money into environmental awareness and some kind of research and so on. The Corps of Engineers, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, said that they want to remodel the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and call it the U.S. Army Corps of Environmental Engineers. These are very major people making very, very astounding statements. They're very worried. Thatcher's declared herself a sustainable development hippie. She's really into it. She's calling herself green. All over the world, these people are really worried. And if they're worried, they know a lot more than we do. They're getting some of the stuff that we won't be allowed to see.
I think some of it is the... we've allowed ourselves, not just as a nation, but as a world of nations, to delude ourselves that this wasn't happening and focus rather on economic means. We've been all keeping up with the Joneses so much that that's been our primary concern. And we haven't wanted to look in our backyard and see the huge trash pile that's growing there and threatening to inundate us. You know, we can build a better fence, you know, to hide it from ourselves. And I think that's what we've been doing for the last 10, 20 years. And now it's not just in our backyard, it's in our front yard, it's all around. It's up to here, and we can't breathe very well anymore without attending to it.
U.S. is almost a laughingstock. I mean, when it comes to environmental issues, we produce by far the largest amount of environmentally damaging effluents, et cetera, et cetera. And yet we have some hues and cries from our own population to save the rainforest, et cetera, et cetera. And those governments in areas in Central South America, where these rainforests are located, are saying, okay, U.S., as soon as you start cleaning up your stuff up there, then we'll start saving the rainforests for you. But until then, you got to make a move. You got to get rid of your environmental wastes that we in other countries all feel.
But if we
we're just a big rich guy sitting here in the corner of the world and telling everybody else to clean up so we can use more.
If we produce a quarter of the carbon that's threatening with its greenhouse effect, a quarter of the world's carbon, and how are we going to cut down? Somebody said we should cut down our carbon emissions by 90%. How are we going to do that?
Put a chemist or not.
Well, any effort we make has to be collective and comprehensive. You can't just, there's no one smoking gun that you can find and deal with. It's any serious solution is going to have to affect us in all forms of our life, all levels of our life. It's going to impact society greatly. We're going to have to reorient our thinking about travel, shopping, our use of resources in those areas. They're all very interrelated. We're going to have to become conscientious consumers rather than brain dead consumers who go into convenience stores and take whatever. We're going to have to be aware that every product we buy is somehow contributing to the problems that we see. You know, it's not a closed system. Everything's connected. You buy a soft drink, and there's so many things that go into it, and every part of that production chain is a pollutant in one way or another. And that's not saying that you just stop everything and stop buying, but we have to redirect our thoughts and efforts. We have to stop this unconscious life we've been living in and become conscious, and it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be without a great deal of pain.
How are you going to get people to do that? How are you going to get people to realize how important that is so they'll make the change?
I don't know. I'm not one who's really optimistic about forcing society to change. I don't think you can direct things from the top. You have to facilitate the knowledge, make it as presentable as possible, and then hopefully people that'll raise their awareness and their own self-interest will take hold, and they'll start changing when they see the wisdom of that change.
In 10 years?
That's the problem. I mean, I don't know. You know, one easy solution is to establish totalitarian governments all over the world that have an eco-consciousness, you know, and then they can dictate from on high. And 10 years, yes, we might be able to change everything radically.
Eco-Noriega.
Eco-Noriega, yeah, or eco-Alatoa Khomeini.
Speaking of trying to get people to move, I work, like I said, work for a utility company, and beginning next year, 2 days from now, we're going to have a big push for the 90s to start a bunch of new conservation programs. Working in the marketing area, I've studied a lot of things about what gets people to move. And it's usually money. I mean, if you pay people to do stuff, they'll move. Back in the days in the 70s when I was working on our weatherization programs to insulate people's houses, there was a real fear that the price of electricity was just going to skyrocket. Well, it turned out it went up for a couple more years, and then in our area it's flattened out for the last 6 years. Haven't had a rate increase. People haven't had any signals that anything is going to change, and we don't want to raise the rates because we know what happens when rates get raised, and people just get up in arms, they get angry at you as a utility, and the utility becomes less competitive. So raising rates, while it is a very effective way of getting people to use less of your product, it also arouses anger and complaints. So some New England utilities have already started this a couple years ago, literally paying for kilowatt hours or electricity that is saved. Right now they are in dire need of electricity in New England, and so they pay the full cost for it. We're trying to look at programs next year that address people's self-interest, just like we mentioned over here. Financing, some kind of monetary incentives. But a big area where much more energy is wasted, other than in homes, is in businesses. And getting businesses to move is like, you know, pushing something uphill. It's just very difficult. I don't know how you get a business's attention other than to just pay for it. Tremendous amount of waste in businesses. And lighting systems alone.
But Doug, I just read a study which said if we instituted all these energy savings on all the appliances and cogeneration and all the things you can think of, we'd have 6 billion tons of carbon instead of 9 billion, which we would have if we didn't do that. So we will still have as much carbon being emitted as we have right now because of the growth in demand. All we'll do is prevent a rise in the amount of emissions. We won't really cut back significantly.
I think you may have a point. I'm a little younger, perhaps, than a lot of people here, and I guess that I'll...
A little louder.
That permits me to be a bit more outrageous, but... there's a lot of people who are writing about alternative economics and environmental economics and have come up with a lot of different ideas for doing that kind of stuff. But there is a basic fundamental difference between the way an ecosystem works and the way the economy works. The economy is based on growth and it expands. The ecosystem is based on stability, on a self-regulating system. We have been living throughout civilization, at least as far as I understand it, with a growing, expanding society, using more and more resources, and we've come to a threshold. And our hope is that we can realize that. An analogy would be, we're not living on the interest, we're just eating up the capital. We have to start living on the interest. And until we can make that shift, and it's an incredible shift. I mean, I don't have any answers. I don't think any of us do, really. What we have to start doing is come to some consensus on that. I don't think taxes or legislation are going to do that. I think it has to be a massive change of will. I think we just have to start realizing that something is really a big problem. One of the most hopeful things I saw this year, I was in Sweden, and a group of companies and the state television company and the government got together and sent to every household in the country a 40-page booklet on the ecological crisis and a tape, a 40-minute cassette tape, and then there was a series of 2 or 3 TV programs following that. I mean, you say, why haven't we heard about it? The whole country, you know, the government spent thousands and thousands of dollars doing this. People are being informed. And I'm concerned that in the United States, maybe people haven't been told yet. But in Canada, the country was the first. Canada was the first country to respond to our common future and produced a national task force report. The trouble is that the term's already been co-opted. That report said there's no need to preserve a particular mix of resources as long as we keep sort of adapting what we're doing and shifting in our priorities and stuff. It's very optimistic. And already businesses, on the radio the other day, someone was saying they're going to build a third runway, concrete out this hole in this marsh. And he was saying over the radio, someone saying, what about environmental problems? And this engineer was saying, well, we're going to develop it sustainably. I mean, these people are using the term that people already begin to think, well, the scientists have got it figured out. The fact is they haven't. Science is not the answer. We have to make a many, many concessions and take a lot of cuts. We cannot support the third world at anything like the living standard that we're at. The Brundtland Commission's book argued for a 5- to 10-fold increase in industrial development in the third world, be it environmentally sound or not. We can't support that use of resources. We just cannot do it. And the awful truth is that if we're at this level of consumption, and they're at this level of consumption, we cannot do this. What we have to do is this. And you start saying that on a political platform and you don't get very far. We are going to have to take a cut in our standard of living, or the rest of the countries can continue to be exploited. Only so long, because the environmental problem is backing up on us. We are discharging wastes, and the toxic accumulation is coming back. It's no longer a national problem. We can't sit in our ivory tower and exploit the guys out there, because the problem is coming right back in our face. We have to do this on a global level, and that's something we really have to start realizing, that there's no longer okay to say, well, we're okay here and we can maintain our standard of living or just take a little cut. We're going to have to take some very serious steps. I can say that I'm young.
Yeah, Julian, the Reagan administration and their trickle-down theory would argue that, you know, this is the reality. Here we are. Here's the third world. The only way we're going to raise the third world is to move up here ourselves and bring them up here to where we were. And you know, I guess there's a certain wisdom in that, you know, if you look at it in a one perspective dimension. I remember a politician in Seattle who later went on to work in the EPA, Marvin Dernan. He had the analogy, cowboys in the spaceship. The idea was that the designers of the Apollo moon mission and the capsule, they designed it to sustain life for 3 astronauts and you couldn't tell them that, well, hey, let's just put a few more in here, you know, three more astronauts, it's no big deal, you know, because the life support system was could only sustain that many. The idea of unlimited growth, which has sort of been the ethos of Americans' development, you know, we started out on the East Coast and spread west as fast as we could, and now we're filling in the gaps that we left with pavement and asphalt and what have you. And the idea that we can just keep going on like that denies rational thought. I mean, there are limits. And
or even if we continue the way that we're doing.
Yeah. I'd like to say something after hearing a lot of this. I just want to say that I think the majority of, at least people that I know, are very aware of the environmental crisis. For instance, Seattle had started one of the first recycling household recycling things and are giving free composting and things like that. And we had taken, a friend and I had taken, actually Paul and I had taken a trip up to Banff last year, and when you go up there, the first thing they hand you is a whole fact sheet, much of what you quoted about acid rain, and especially in the eastern side of the states and how it's affecting the provinces in the east of Canada. So, I mean, it is very much aware, but what do you do when the massive, the most garbage that's being produced is by businesses right now, and what do you do when a whole economic and political system, like you said, is built on growth and new technology? Every industry is based on that, and they aren't looking at environmental things. Usually they're looking at how to save money. And as far as even utilities, and I have no idea about what you do or anything, but, you know, they charge, like what I had read in New England, yeah, they're having a cold winter, so what do? They charge people more. And in Seattle, when you have electricity rates, they charge you double in the winter. I don't get it. It's all money, and it all comes down to that. And so how, I think, rather than hearing all this philosophy, which I very much agree with, I start to get anxious. Okay, I need concrete answers. I agree with all this, and I love the environment. What can we do to curb this and to impact the biggest offenders? Which, I don't know. And if anybody has any answers, I'd love to hear about it. Because I just start to really get bummed out when I hear some of that. I need to hear a way in which we can affect change.
I think I'm convinced that, into your comment about businesses and about a lot of the waste comes from businesses. Legal means, putting fines on the waste stream, you know, how much it costs, and make it so that the economic signal is there. Mm-hmm. And when the utilities raise their rates in the winter, they're trying to give an economic signal, use less. Mm-hmm. And because it costs more for them to produce it, listening to your reaction, you feel that they're gouging you.
Well, especially when people depend on electric heat, for instance.
Right, right.
And they're having to pay double for that amount. And especially, I work with people on fixed incomes and things like that.
I can suggest that there are a number of ways that you can bring down the usage so that even though the rates may double, the usage gets cut in half, so you're where you ended up in the first place. I don't think people are so much concerned about rates as much as they are their bills.
Doug, I think we are really talking about money, bottom line.
If it costs that's the way more, that our society
if thinks. It costs more, whatever it is, mm-hmm. electric power, wrapping papers, that's the decision basis at which, the level at which we operate. You're in a unique kind of business because you control the whole supply, so to speak. There's not alternate company B that also offers electrical power over the same grid. But take a business which doesn't have that kind of unique niche. If I'm producing widgets, and he can produce them for a little less money using a different technology, most folks will buy his widgets. Mm-hmm. Look at the grocery store. Buy organic vegetables, they cost you more than non-organically grown. So what do most of us buy? Mm-hmm. We buy the cheaper ones. Mm-hmm. And so that is still the operational level that we're at.
Mm-hmm. Here's the interesting thing.
What you were saying about cost, you know, putting the cost in where the consumption takes place or where the extraction takes place out of the environment, those things have not been done. And I agree with you, money sort of moves a lot of things. If you take an energy company and cost, or let's say a logging company, you know, there's one area where it's they're just sort of given free lunch. They're sold these trees and they're given access to the trees by our government at very uncompetitive prices, and then they sell that at a maximum profit, and then they you know, they're not putting back what they take out. I mean, we've had extraction industries as our major gross national product producer for the last two centuries, you know, and the idea that they can just take from the environment, from the resource of the planet, without paying back anything, or that water is a resource, and people are allowed to just dump into that water all the pollutants they want. If they want to do that, let them pay for it. Let them pay the full cost that is entailed in cleaning that water up 10, 20, 100 years down the road. If a nuclear energy wants to produce nuclear energy, let them guarantee that they'll cover every cost that's ever involved with their pollution to the environment. You know,
in theory, that's great.
In theory, I know.
Matter, it hasn't worked.
Legally speaking, if we plan for a new power plant and we say, boy, load is growing like this, people are using more, and we're going to need the power plant at time Z, we cannot charge you, at least here in Oregon, we cannot charge you for that power before it comes online. So you get no signal. There's no economic signal out there. So we could be selling you 5 cent kilowatt hour electricity. Then when the growth gets to the point we build the power plant, and we have to plan for that 10 years in advance, which is very expensive, then we jack up the rates to 8 cents all of a sudden. Then you get the signal. Then you cut your use down. Then the plant has no use, and you have this big dinosaur city.
Well, you're talking about whoops, really, Doug, because what happened? They cannot recoup the lost investment in those plants. And whether you are for or against nuclear energy, the utilities and the PUDs poured an enormous amount of money into those things, which has zero return.
How
all those things are in default.
Practice. How will you allow us to give you the signal to use less beginning now? Because if you start using less now, then the rate of load growth, or maybe even a load decrease.
I am in accord with you. What I'm saying is, been tried and failed, the political outcome is we don't want to pay for that turkey now.
Right.
Don't put that on my bill. Find some other way to pay for it. And there is no other way to pay for it.
I think you're right. The political consciousness has to change. You know, there has to be, across the board, the voting public has to say, listen, this is going to cost us not just a change of lifestyle, but it's going to cost us dollars and cents.
Why is everything in this whole conversation based on money, on economics? I think we have a Christian responsibility as a people of God to nurture and sustain the sacredness of the environment. So I think, you know, if you could look at the statistics and how many Americans are church-going people, you know, if you could use the churches as a basis of a means to let people know in their churches that it's a responsibility as a Christian people
mm-hmm.
to nurture
do.
And sustain their creation, instead of always bringing it back to the dollar.
Well, you'll also hear, I mean, I've heard this from people who are, you know, great Christian people, and their argument is, as far as I'm concerned, they're ignorant, and they don't see the damage that they're doing to the environment, and they really see that they have this kind of, quote, dominion over the earth. And no matter, it's like, you know, you have a Republican and Democrat Christian, or you have people torn over Central America, and they're both believing in the same Bible and the same God, but they believe two different things. You know, that's a hard line to try to mend within the church. And I see a lot of people who are in the church who see, they don't yet see what their sacredness or relationship to nature is to dominate it, and that it is there for their usage, and that usage can be
justified.
Whatever motivation we can use to get people to move, my question is, what do we say they should move toward? And some people have proposed a carbon tax. The one I've heard was 15 $50 a ton of carbon, which would raise gasoline 17 cents. That seems to me to be a pittance. But you could put on a carbon tax, which would tax all carbon emissions. I would think it'd be $300 or $400 a ton to be effective at all, and get that gasoline tax up to $1 or $2, and get coal tax up, and utility rates would go up, and everything would go up. But you would get an instrument to force utilities, force everybody into paying some of the costs down the line, and to get efficiency. I think that's the way you get efficiency.
That's a vicious circle. How do you get this instrument politically?
Oh, of course.
It already has the political support by the changed consciousness of people.
Of course.
And then how do you change it? The consciousness apparently is not ripe yet or whatever.
It's already taking place in New England, where they add on, and in California, where the utility commissions, which regulate the utilities, are letting the utilities charge X amount more to pay for all their conservation programs. I mean, that's so they can avoid that new generating plant. So it's already happening.
There is some movement. Minneapolis and St. Paul have a regulation now. You can't sell food in plastic containers. You can't do it. They won't allow it in the town. That's a good Lutheran town, I think.
And in Portland, Oregon, McDonald's can't even sell styrofoam packaged stuff.
Yeah. It may seem small, but there is some consciousness that you can appeal to.
And I think that contributes to the consciousness raising. I don't think that will actually tackle the problem.
Of course it won't tackle the problem of the ozone depletion.
But it won't normally tackle the problem of the way we think about consumption. You're saying everything comes down to money. That's what we have to change.
Exactly.
And I think we're kidding ourselves if we're going to use taxation to make the difference. Herman Daly has written any number of books on environmental economics, and you can argue it one way or the other. You can't prove who the polluter is half the time, so you can't get them in legislation, so there's no tax to be given. There's incredible problems in the actual implementation of some of those things. We have to go back down to more root level and say, well, if we can only get people to agree that there's a major problem and to begin to see how that problem is related to the way we all live, then we stand a chance. Because if a democracy means anything, the political system should respond to that. Yeah. It happens in small areas. There are small groups of people that have affected that change. Again, I'm living in BC. You can see some of that happening there. There's a conservation strategy being put together. People are recycling. People are willing to drive considerable distances to take their waste to recycle. Small community centres are getting this stuff together. It is beginning to happen, but I think we have to stop thinking of technical, quick solutions to the economy, because to change the economy somehow. We have to actually just uproot it, and that's very scary. I haven't lived long enough to know
how do we get their attention first?
Well,
a bunch of rate increases in order
to go to Sweden and see whether people have any different change of sense there.
You
if we have 10 or 15
taxes.
Or even 50
stop
years.
Paying taxes, yeah.
Yeah, but in Sweden, they had a national mandate to what, not use nuclear power or to decline its use?
No, we use it.
Sweden does it.
Sweden's
got all kinds of
Denmark.
Where am I thinking about?
Norway.
Italy had it, Switzerland had it, Italy. In Italy, their referendum was successful. They abandoned nuclear power. But that is particularly ironic because all the nuclear power plants were down at the time.
It works in
Switzerland.
Typical in
Switzerland, which is at least.
Tom, what's happening in Germany with the Green Party? I just read a book by Barrow who said we ought to establish 3,000 member communities with no automobiles and complete self-sufficiency. Not complete, but almost. And we ought to just really transform our whole way of relating and what we're about. And growth is out, and having all these things is out. Is that realistic? Is that happening in Germany?
Well, the Green Party, I mean, it's a whole speech by itself. The problem with the Green Party in relation to the United States would be that the Green Party in Germany is a very well-established political party that has lost its grassroots origin. They are not very active on an initiative basis in the community. They don't have something like bioregionalism. That is something that is new in the States, and it's successful in the States, and it's establishing itself. And it seems that the Green Movement in the United States still is hesitant to express itself politically. because it wants to be active. It wants to answer those questions. What can the everybody, the person in the street do? And that's more important to the American. It's, it goes probably back to individualism and the pioneer, whatever. It has totally different origins than in Germany, people always being oriented towards the state. You have to fund a party that moves the state, and the state then moves us. That's a totally different concept of how politics works, and I think the American approach would, in the long run, be more successful. On a grassroots basis, in bioregionalism, or whatever you want to call it, they are already more successful. I mean, Germany has done a lot to clean up rivers, environment, air, and so on a basis where the state dictates. And sure, the consciousness also has changed, but it's not as successful. Scandinavia is a totally different case because I think Scandinavians have a different relationship to nature. They're, I would almost say, born with a different consciousness, environmental consciousness. And there are enormous social, psychological differences between countries that you have to consider when you look at another country as a model. Don't take the Green Party as a model. I would vote for the Green Party in Germany, no question, because that's the way it works there. But I would not think of founding a Green Party in the United States, because you cannot compete with Republicans and Democrats, and the way of doing politics in terms of coalitions cannot be thought of in this country.
But what about that?
Local and very limited, and they have nothing to do with the Green Party.
What kind of things are they doing?
Well, for instance, organizing recycling, they adopt rivers, there are all different kinds of groups in the community adopt rivers, and they control those rivers to point out polluters. Mm-hmm. They set up private air control stations, and it's really a grassroots movement. Everybody is sort of getting involved, because consciousness has changed so much. And it's also partly thanks to the Green Party. They have moved a lot. But they are not directly involved anymore. They are now a lobby.
But they raised the consciousness.
Yeah, they did.
Trying to think of what Julian's...
They broke some political barrier. Mm-hmm. That certainly helped. But that is more possible in Germany, where the government very often is in a coalition. And a tiny party can play an enormous role. And that might happen in the next election, when the Social Democrats and the Greens might get together.
But do you think that with the recent failure of the communist system or state in Eastern Europe, that the whole world can't sustain capitalism, that the Green Party might be more than a small party, it might be a viable option in the near future to replace the communist ideal that seems to be crumbling?
That is so far, considering the party platform of the Green Party, impossible, because they endorse themselves so many socialist ideals that they can be easily discredited by saying, well, you are the very socialists that you now want to be the alternative for. Environmental issues are very big for citizens in East Germany, because they are living on a dump site. It's awful, and the Green Party is for them no alternative, really, because they align the Green Party too much still with socialism. That's different in West Germany, where capitalism is so dominant, and where the Greens are an alternative just because they also have socialist ideas of doing economics.
Don't you think if we had something that moved from a grassroots movement Green Party into actually a viable party here in the United States? And the way I think of, and this is maybe a criticism and I shouldn't say this, but the way I see the people in the United States sometimes is that they need an authority figure. Even though they think of themselves all these great individuals, they want an authority figure. They want the government to tell them, oh no, everything is okay. I have solved all the problems. I am taking care of everything. Don't you worry. And then the people think, okay, everything's okay. And if they had a party up there that was like a real stable political entity that they said, there are some real problems out there, and da da da, that maybe people would go, gosh, you know, the government is starting to really say something. And I don't feel like my government has really said something. And I know that I know people who would respond to that, who won't respond to me telling them something or a little article that they read in the paper.
Well, but
they listen to the government before they listen to a friend?
That may sound bad, but that might hit them in a way that they don't take me so seriously, or they don't yet see it, or, I mean,
I see.
Hey, I would disagree with that. I think part of our problem is that our government has no credibility with most of us. We don't believe much of what they say, and I think that's part of the breakthrough that must occur.
I think there are a lot of people who do believe what our government says is true. There are a lot of people out there.
They believe the good news that they want to hear, but they don't believe the bad news.
I think that's
why they like Reagan so much. That's why.
Well, they need the right show. They know it's a show, but they need the right show. And the Green Party gives them the peace of mind they want as a show. I mean, it's tricky.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, your first question about the church, and historically America has been moved many times by the church, all churches, the Christian, the Jewish, and if that's where America's consciousness still is, I'm not sure, but if it is still there and you can tap that, then I think that's a great place to start, you know. But there I see big problems, you know. I see the church needs to reorient itself on its basic theology, I think, in some ways. It needs to throw off these ideas that, well, you know, this world is passing and we're going on to a better one, and therefore, you know, we don't need to really be concerned. You know, praise God, I'm saved. You know.
An interesting observation about the church and environmentalism is that Oregon, who we can say is one of the most environmentally oriented states, has one of the smallest churched populations. Now, there's an indictment. That's what, 20-30% of the population in Oregon is churched.
Well, we're all created by the Christian civilization, whether we accept it or not. But I won't get into that. What I heard,
you can't work through the churches in Oregon.
What I heard Julian saying is probably what I wanted to hear him say. Was that there are two ways to approach this problem. One is a kind of reform way, a technical response to a technical problem, and there are all kinds of fixes that you could invent, and technologies and energy savings. And the other way I heard him say was there's a fundamental issue with the whole ethos of Western civilization that thinks of growth and the increase in the production of things, and we all measure the life of a nation by its GNP, by its output, and there should be a whole new scale of measurements of successful operation of a society. And so you have to create a new concept of what it means to be whole human, real,
sustainable
is too much connected with reform. It's to sustain our present operation. It's a way to redo things so we can sustain our present way of life. What I heard Julian saying, with which I, about 90% of me agrees, at least 90%, is that what we're about is going to pollute. It's going to destroy. There's no way, given our value system and what we want, what Americans want, and the kind of image of America we've created in the third world, and therefore what they want, there's no way with those wants to create a healthy world. That's what I heard you say.
How do we change that?
But I think we're struggling to find a blueprint all the time. We're talking about the political system, the kind of system we want to introduce. I don't think there is a blueprint out there. The only societies I know of are some of the native societies and the indigenous societies. There's a group I was working with in northern India, in the Himalayas, which is definitely the closest I've seen to a sustainable society. There are societies that have been marginalized on the West Coast, very close to where you are now. Chief Seattle in 1854 wrote an extraordinary document, which it's on sale in the bookshop, you know, that some of these people have models. We can't go back to those models, but there are some ideas of how people can live together. I don't know whether that's a blueprint we can model on or use or even adapt somehow, but there are some good models to say some of these things we struggle with about our consumerism and the relationship with each other and so on have been figured out in societies that had great deal of stability and commitment to place and so on. And we might be able to draw from some of those.
But that would move so slow.
Of course it would, and we have 10 years. And Paul Ehrlich said that if there's an issue attention cycle, or as he puts it rather more cynically, an issue accommodation cycle, we can't afford to let this one go because we haven't got another one. And that's pretty wild.
So and when you say we have... Oh, sorry.
What we're saying is we're doomed.
No, I'm saying we have to get very, very busy.
Very, very
busy. Very busy. Very
jump on your horse and do like Paul Revere, you know.
And instead of believing the one in four chance, just take a leap of faith and say, okay, let's assume it's happening. And if it doesn't, I'll be the first one to stand up and clap my hands and say, thank goodness, that's great. But I'm not prepared to risk it. I'm just not prepared to
do it. But you really want the fundamental drive of the Western society and to stop the engines that are producing and will continue to produce and will continue to lobby for and will continue to throw all their weight against any movement for a rational reform.
If the way I have been led to see the problem is the way the problem is, if that is reality and the problem is really one of the basic consumerism, that's what we have to change. And if the consequence of that is, yes, we have to change Western ideology, sure, that's what we're dealing with. I can't get away from the analysis which tells me that's what the problem is. I can't somehow ignore that and say, well, there's a minor reform that'll do the job. I'm dealing with a picture of reality that says there is a major transformation that needs to occur.
My own feeling is, conviction is, that you've got to work on the reform in the hopes that working on the reform is going to open up the possibilities for the other to occur. Because sure. You can't work sure. If you can't work fast enough to get a revolution in consciousness that's deep enough and significant enough to change things, but it may come out of the realization of what is needed for reform and the kind of failure almost of some of the reform to produce it that may bring enlightenment or bring a new consciousness. So I think I've got to work on reform for the time being. Even though I'd like to work in the other direction and start forming new societies.
If I could interject a hopeful note here, I think one of the reasons we're so pessimistic is we feel so much inertia behind all of this. You know, our society has organized itself in this manner and we feel that it's just going to grind on and grind on and grind right over us and all of our petty concerns, the big concerns. And yet, just this fall, we've seen a very dramatic, hopeful change in a place where we thought inertia was such that our best minds were saying, oh yeah, 50, 100 years, you know, the wall will come down. And like that, it was gone. And, you know.
But what brought that about, Kevin?
I don't know.
Did things reach a critical crisis point?
Yeah, and that's happening.
But how many people accept that? I mean, clearly the East Germans did and the rest of Eastern Europe.
But I think it caught everyone by surprise, the people who participated in it as well as the people who observed it from other countries.
Maybe it's the 100th monkey thing.
Maybe it's the 100th monkey thing, but I think there was crisis all around them all the time, and yet people do like people do. They wake up in the morning, put on their clothes, go to work. Suddenly, you know, it reaches such a mass of awareness or whatever that it clicks. That's the only hopeful sign I really see right now. I'm hoping that awareness is happening and has been for 20 years. It's growing. I don't meet many people that aren't aware that there is some environmental problem. No matter how out of touch they are with society, they have some awareness now. If that can raise to such a level that this 100th monkey thing kicks in, which is a concept that we imitate after a while. Everything reaches and then it just jumps out across the broad spectrum.
Well, I think it's going to come from our, I just want to say, I don't think it's going to come from our political system.
No.
And it will have to come from, I mean, because our society elevates people like Donald Trump, and bigger is better, and things like that, and that's just not compatible with what we're talking about. And I don't know, maybe churches is a good place to start, but somehow, I mean, things have been passed in this country, started in a grassroots level, maybe.
I think moving from awareness to action
is always a, I mean, that's look at marketing type philosophy. You can get a person very aware of a particular product, but it takes something to get them to move. And that's a, that could be, that maybe that, I don't know the 100 monkey story, and I don't want somebody to tell it right now. But that's,
I don't really think that the analogy to politics works in that sense with the East, what happened in the East, where they had a clear opponent. The opponent for the Western world, in terms of environmental pollution, it's ourselves, still ourselves. We still got here in one way or the other with a car. And it's just, it's so simple. I mean, the way we are kind of entangled with ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think I should call us formally to halt.
Oh, we're not done. You can go out.
We haven't solved.
No. I don't think there's anything more important. In fact, that's why I pushed to have this tonight. And I don't think there's anything more important than this. But if people are thinking that they'll miss the whatever is going on over there.
So we can keep going?
We can keep going, of course.
To pick up on his point.
I love it.
Organisms and organizations don't, by their nature, destroy themselves. Somebody's got to do it. You have to have a sunset law that creates this thing and then gives it a fuse and shuts it down. Or it continues to go and perpetuate itself until it crashes. I throw that out for a hypothesis, because if that's true, and I think it is, you're exactly right. We are the enemy, and we're very hard-pressed to change the behaviors on a broad enough scale to change the direction that it's going in any significant way.
And that's why certain people gravitate towards a group like Earth First that says that...
they're creating those crisis points where the whole thing slams into a wall and has to be put back together again in some different fashion.
Did you say you don't believe that organisms are self-destructive? I'm
talking about political for the
moment.
They'll perpetuate themselves.
Say,
they want to perpetuate themselves.
I think human
themselves.
Beings are very self-destructive.
And social structures
okay,
for the most part.
Now,
there are some biologic things that do that. But
we're the only system that doesn't do that. I mean, the natural systems all have self-regulation. Or adapt. We're the only one that doesn't.
But sometimes I think that we think that just because social structures are self-perpetuating, that they have a life of their own, but we give them their life, and we can snub that life with a critical consciousness pretty quickly, it seems.
Yeah, I want to make a point about what our society has done that's good. First is, in our society, we were great smokers. Mm-hmm. And in America, we had a Surgeon General and a whole plan that was national that said, look, smoking isn't good for you. And they went to the kids in school and they started training them to say to their daddies and their mommies, we don't want you smoking anymore. America's changed terribly, wonderfully, that it's really cut down. Look, I doubt that anybody here smokes, though I see those little butts cans all over. But when we travel in Europe, and even in England, it's puff, 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 puff. And here these are socialist countries that supposedly are really being guided in health programs. I want to give another example that's hopeful. In the state of Washington, we work for Pure Water, and we happen to get on a watershed committee. Now, that was sponsored by the Washington state government, who furnished us with a young ecologist who kind of guided. We saw every kind of community member come out, including people who said, don't step on my property or we'll shoot you on sight. But they pointed out that our waters were being ruined in Puget Sound by animals getting into the streams, by loggers dumping all their oil and waste into the streams, by logging, and by even mistakes that the U.S. Forest Service was making. Out of all that, we have made all over Washington codes of ethics that we painstakingly work on. It took us a year and a half. It was sponsored by government, but it really came from the grassroots. I learned so much that my brain is bursting with ecological things, which I already believed in, but I learned so much more. So did those hard-bitten farmers.
Washington State is one of the remarkable stories in Northwest North America because of one court decision called the Bolt decision, which reallocated fish, and that led to the Timber Fish and Wildlife Agreement, and it was one political decision that had a knock-on effect it wasn't a grassroots thing. That came from the top. When somebody over here said that they didn't think the political system could affect that change, I think it can. If William Colby can stand there on live TV and say, we have a natural security problem, I want to cut military spending, that guy's done an amazing turnabout. You know, if those people as well start doing something, maybe in the middle we can meet. Mm-hmm. Some
What's
of these
this
things
person's that, position now? This Colby person.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, that most politicians get enlightened when they leave office. I don't know what he's doing now.
He's retired and collecting his pension that he made from profiting from what he's now condemned. And I'm sorry to be pessimistic, but there's not going to go there too much of that, you know. And I don't know. I'd like to think that's a real hopeful sign, but when these retired people collecting their pensions suddenly do an about face, I get a little cynical.
But that's when they get their freedom.
Yeah.
You know,
well, exactly.
That's when they say, now, just like I work for a utility company who happened to have the only nuclear plant in Oregon, and there is a, you know, a vision that people see of all employees in the utility company, and then there's a bunch of us that all say that we need to move forward to using less energy and using other forms that are renewable, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know,
Doug lives in a solar house in town,
you know, for quite some time. But
74 was
there's the public thing, and then there's the private thing. And I can talk to my blue in the face in the utility company and say, we need more solar power. And they say, well, that's nice, but it's not economic. There's another set of rationality that the utility has that I don't have to have. I mean, I can go buy a solar house if I want to. I don't have to prove it on it. But maybe that's the thing that allows William Colby to speak his conscience.
See, that's the point.
And Jimmy Carter.
Yeah. One of the other things that can occur is that there could be another major environmental catastrophe, which is localized. Chernobyl, Exxon Valdez, there's so many. There only has to be one. I mean, if you know, Exxon Valdez had happened between Vancouver Island and Puget Sound, for instance, I think it would be a fairly major shift of people. So they'd start asking some pretty big questions. It's a sort of dangerous hope that there'll be one. But I almost hope there will, because I think in that sense, people might get kicked into gear. And I don't think gradual change necessarily is always the way. I think there is an analogy with East Germany in that suddenly something very unexpected happens and we don't quite prepare ourselves for it.
Did people see the connection between Exxon Valdez and their automobile sitting in the garage?
I don't know.
That's a rhetorical question.
Yeah, well, I saw 100 bumper stickers at least on cars driving around, you know, that boycott Exxon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, boycott.
You know, and I thought,
boycott your car. Take
you know, boycott here it is, cruising down the freeway 65 miles an hour, boycott Exxon. Okay, sure, let's boycott Exxon, but, you know, where are you getting your gas from? And they were just lucky that their tanker didn't crash on those rocks, you know. There's no difference. Mm-hmm.
From what we're looking at for our conservation program from the 90s, we have to get a lot of our new power from our customers. We have 500,000 of them. Or about a million people, 500,000 buildings. So how do you organize that body of people to admit that they are the reason why even the utility exists?
The same way that the Carter administration did when we had the big crisis over Middle East oil. And he asked the whole nation to conserve, and the people went to work. Again, I organized high school groups in my classes to do it. And the kids loved it. And I think that we can change everything by getting it into education from kindergarten on, from preschoolers on. The little kids come home and they nag their mommies and daddies about it. Mm-hmm. And the parents get proud, and I think the churches are a good effect there, that they become a group that says, this is our beloved world. Let's help take care of it. And the child says, we want to live, mom and dad. We have to do it. But the utility companies did do it. They came to their, you know, they came and wrapped our hot water heaters. Everyone cut down on lights. Christmas tree lights weren't even put on. There were many changes that took place when Carter asked us to do it. I think if we had some kind of a true environmental president, they would use Greenpeace and all these organizations, which most of us belong to make changes in the world, to say it's okay to be conservationists.
A smart leader would do that. That's
absolutely
right. I agree with that. Educational system is an excellent way.
But we had the great communicator who told us, you know, don't worry, be happy. You know, there's no problems.
Set us back 8 years.
You know, it's not so scary that he said that.
you know, I don't blame him at all for saying that. What I was frightened about was that so many people listened. You know?
That we elected.
Yeah. You know, that's great. I don't want to worry. I'll be happy.
I think we have a situation somewhat like the civil rights situation that we've just been reading about King and parting the waters. And what people went through to create the consciousness that there was a civil rights issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, people really felt that there was something serious. I think if some of us felt it was as serious as we say it is, and began to put our bodies on the line to create the consciousness, this is a matter of life and death. I think it is a matter of life and death.
That's just it. Back to the East Germany analogy, there, since the wall was put up, there was people that were trying to climb it every day. People trying to get over it every day, and they were killed or shot or imprisoned or something. Are there people that are trying to climb the wall we're talking about now? Are there people that are getting rid of their cars? People that are making these major, major decisions?
And hopefully some king will emerge to lead them. I mean, there has to be a new prophet emerge. Somehow, yeah. We've got to get some... This has got to be dramatic. It's got to... We got to get our folk singers. We got to get the culture moving somehow.
I don't see a leader moving up the ranks that
who knows?
Has that kind of...
Who knows?
That is going to tell people, I think we're going to have you all use less.
Nothing's been said this evening about the growing evidence that electromagnetic radiation may prove lethal. Mm-hmm. This is...
I've been reading up on
Yes, you've been reading about it, and something like this may be a terrific jolt that'll... After all, it's our primary source of energy, or one of the most important ones. What if that proves to be another cancer in our technical society?
Yeah, that's the thing, like global warming, it'll add more to the case, which for many people, just conserving to save money is not enough. You know, well, what about global warming? Well, I guess that does add some more to the case. What about EMF, or electromagnetic fields problems? Well, there's another thing, we're not sure about it, but that just adds more... How much do you have to fuel on the fire do you have to have before people start taking decisions, making decisions in their own lives?
I think people get paralyzed by all the problems. I mean, I read this every day, and it's pretty depressing stuff. You know, so many people are saying it again and again and again, and people, some of them are listening, some of them aren't, and the changes aren't occurring. The only response I can have is start working at it. Just start doing what you can. I don't see any excuse for it why any of us can't do what little we can. And as things become clearer and as we start forming consensus about the problems and the way we might want to solve them, we can start making those changes. But I think we're paralyzing ourselves into saying, what is the blueprint for the answer? And I can't draw the blueprint. This is such a fundamental change. We have no precedent. There's no social precedent for the kind of changes we're anticipating. There's no political precedent. There's certainly no sort of technical precedent to taking away all this technology we've got. We're doing something very different, and I think we have to do it. So let's get going. I mean, there's so many things we can do. And
are you a teacher?
No, I'm not a teacher.
You should be.
There's lots we can do. There's any number of magazines which will give you a list of 101 things you can do in your home. Great, do 101, and then think about
it's getting your business to move that I'm worried about.
But if everyone did it, maybe the, you know, it's like we can't worry about them right now. We haven't got the time.
Al, what one of the massive organizations that we do have entree to is to here is the church across the U.S. What I'd be real curious what ideas folks might have about some of the strategies we could begin to think about from theological strategies down to asking churches to become green zones to
Can I just interject on that?
Yeah.
Because at the conference in Los Angeles in November, GlobeScope, this first conference in the United States on sustainable development, there was one whole forum on the church and equity. And church leaders from all over the country went to that. And the results of that conference, which are put in a pamphlet, are being sent to every municipal office in the country. So you may find that there's already some consensus being formed across different churches within the country. You may want to tap into that. I don't have a lot of information right here I can get to send you some. That's beginning to happen.
There's some real concrete ways, and like I said, I work on marketing programs for conservation, and
that I've rolled around in my mind and a couple other people have, and maybe this is a forum to throw it out here, is that light bulbs, new types that are coming out, use about 1/5 the electricity that typical incandescent light bulbs have. Utilities are starting to toy with ways of how to distribute those. I mean, just to build awareness, just take a couple out to each home just to show people what they are. And, you know, is the church or a church body that can, even among its parishioners, be some kind of distribution point for a very visible thing, just like, here's a light bulb, use 1/5 electricity. Puts out the same amount of light as your others.
Well, I think the church ought, every church ought to have a task force on the ecology, and every church ought to do everything that we're doing here at Holden and have forums like this and have all kinds of literature available and have all these lists. We got 132 things to do, and start getting people conscious of it and begin to ask the question that we've asked here about what it means. What's the feedback on our whole way of life that's involved, and begin to get some people writing on that kind of issue, and begin to get some groups experimenting with moving in that direction. Just, you know, every group you're in, every business, you ought to have a group that that's responsible for this and begins to think through, like the Lutheran School of Theology has now got a group that's thinking through the whole life of the school. Well, if you push that far enough, you soon get into all kinds of issues beyond little things. You get into the big issues. Ed?
I guess I'm troubled by that. In our own congregation, we've tried to move a lot of task force and study groups on different things. Unless people feel the crisis, they don't enlist in your army. Until we have a major brownout in the Northwest, people aren't going to go buy your light bulbs. Some will. You'd have to give them all away, trade them one for one to get any massive use of new light bulbs. You can go down the store right now and buy 75 waters that put out 100, or 50s that put out 75, or whatever it is. And I don't detect any great rush to do those, because there's just as many of the other ones gone as those.
Yeah, 13
I don't think there's that sense of crisis. You know, you well, most would, of us in this room
stir- How would you stir up that sense of crisis in the church?
I'm not sure.
I mean, I've
we could pull a switch at the utility company.
I've been in and out of the church for 15 example, years, our, and I see church. Complacency everywhere, you know, across the perspective. You know, and
what haven't you been in and out of where you see complacency?
Well, that's true. That's good point. It's the human attention span.
I'm in the church, I'm going to work in the church. If I were in a business, I'd be working in the business. I'd have a committee in whatever business I was working in. Well, wherever you are, you got to start it and work at it.
You had a comment.
What you were saying, we had a simple problem with a leaky roof in our church. When does it get fixed? When it leaks on your head. Not when it leaks on the person next to you. I mean, basically, until it hits you, you don't really have that sense of urgency about it, for the most part.
What do you preach in your church then? Do you preach sermons that make people feel good, or do you preach prophetic sermons that tell people, unless they feel uncomfortable the way they're living in the world, that they're not living up to the message that Jesus brought us? I mean, I think preaching, Brueggemann has a new book out now on preaching, about what's being preached in the church, and, you know, it seems like a lot of what I hear in churches is sugar-coated pablum that makes people feel good.
Yeah, whatever's preached in the church. Ed, I think you could change your church. I think you, I've watched you around here a little. If I were in your church, I would get on you and I would help you organize that task force on this issue.
I wish you were in our church.
You know, I would latch on to somebody like you, no, Karen.
Do you sense my frustration?
I
yeah, we all do. I do.
Pick your problem. You know, it's the same problem every time. Yeah.
We have to pay people to get them to save money. Stupid. Mm-hmm. It's a stupid thing. Even businesses that can get 2-year paybacks won't even invest in a new lighting system. Mm. I mean, we're talking here about this is rampant.
Getting the church involved in this, I think. At least I see the church traditionally as being so concerned with
the human element, with the human dilemma, mm-hmm. that we have assumed someone else is going to take care of the environmental problems. It's up to the environmentalists. We church people
are busy enough. Well, God created the environment. He should take care of it.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
But we're busy enough worrying about the people problems that we can't also handle the environmental one. How do we make the link and convince us all that the environment is equally important?
Have you looked at that? Have you looked at that 38-page document that's sitting up there on the table in the dining room that comes out of a Wisconsin synod where they have a whole synod working on becoming creation-centered churches, and they've got 38 pages really on recycling, and this minister is the focus of all that, and he's got a committee from the whole synod, and they're all working on it. I mean, the church is not dead.
We're not saying that, but change the focus a little bit.
Well,
raise the rates as a conservation technique, which is a good one. It does work. But then the church and we find ourselves helping the poor and those who are on limited incomes find the money to pay the new
that's
rates.
Right. Exactly. That's where what I do.
You should make sure
you ignore those people that concentrate on the environment then?
You've got to ignore some to do. You've got to concentrate on the environment. There won't be any people.
Well, I'm highlighting Karen's statement that we are focused on those people rather than on what you're describing, which I'll accept and acknowledge as a more important problem. But that's a crisis that people are able to identify with. They haven't yet moved over to accept the other one in the way they need to.
And even recycling, I must admit, is the beginning step. If we don't get beyond recycling, we haven't started.
Do you have a video machine at your church? Do you have a video machine you have access to? And
sure.
Would people come and watch something? BBC produced a program called Only One Earth, where it's an hour-long program which paints a very clear picture, for me at least, that the problem in Central and Eastern Africa is an environmental problem. What we're talking about is environmental refugees, people, but they're environmental refugees, they're not political refugees or anything else. If we can start linking the damage that's being done to people all over the world, mostly the third world, by environmental problems, we can start seeing it as a very real problem. And I think it's those kind of linkages that are very easy to make, and they're increasingly being made, and people are sort of jolting to realize that. Within the sort of green alternative movement, there are any number of groups. There's the deep ecologists, and there's the Gaia people, and they're all trying to make some of those linkages and feel out where they are. There's no one particular path, but there are things you can tap into that can help people make that connection.
After reading the book, Common Future, getting through most of the book, Time and Future, I was brought to a real awareness as to how closely tied together these energy and environmental problems are to human suffering and human hunger. You know, that's one of our big issues. Well, why do we have hunger? Well, there's deforestation and there's overpopulation or whatever. I mean, there's environmental tie-ins there. There's companies gaining a profit by exploiting certain people. I mean, so I think it's real. So we're closely tied together, that human and the environment.
Much earlier on, I think, forgotten your name.
Julian,
you made the comment that you had observed, or knew of at least, some, what I guess we would call, non-Western civilizations or communities.
The DAC project.
Which basically, as I understand, were basically net sum, took only what they needed. Everything went back into it. Population was basically stable. Mm-hmm. That's basically not true in the world now. Virtually everywhere you look, in greater or lesser degrees, population scales are up. And even if we cut our net growth and use and all the rest of those things, it's overwhelmed by growth elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So that the total consumption levels still are increasing and the total pollutant output still are increasing.
But the question
that's the
is,
underlying bottom line.
What's the character? What's the character of that growth going to be in the third world? And one of my concerns is we don't have anything to say to the third world. There's nothing in American life that I think is relevant, really, for the third world.
They think so.
Beg your pardon?
They think so.
Well, they think so. Well,
many people in the third world elevate our American lifestyle. You go anywhere in Latin America.
But it's unsustainable, so it's useless.
Yeah, but that sounds like a cop out from us to them.
Of course, it sounds like a cop out. So what?
A lot of the population stuff is due to health problems. I mean, where they have babies that tend to die, they have more babies. I mean, those are linked to environment.
Birth rates are higher.
Where literacy rate is higher, the birth rate is lower.
So, but there's so some elements of our society, like literacy and education, and that are, you know, things that don't take a lot of resources.
Depends on what educating them to do.
Everything says there are four things that cause a birth rate to decline. You educate the women, you give them opportunities to work, you raise the standard of living of the whole community, and you give them access to birth control mechanisms, and the population growth will go down. I mean, there's just all kinds of literature and statistics and, you know, tables and all that to show those four things are linked with it. So what we have to do is, in terms of third world development, is to help the third world move in that direction. If you're going to move in that direction, you're going to get rid of our farm subsidies, and you're going to get rid of the debts we have to the third world, and you're going to help them have some money to sustain some development, and you're going to provide a whole network of things that we haven't been willing to provide.
What do you do, though, when the major Latin American countries are Catholic and they're against birth control?
There are several statistics which show that some very, very strong Catholic countries have reduced their birth rates, so that is not an issue, I don't think.
Really. Also, birth rates and have not always been reduced by birth control. It's not necessarily the problem. Many African groups, many African societies have children because that helps them farm the land, not because they don't want to have kids. It's not because they can't help that problem. They want to do that. It gives them some benefit, either economic benefit or social benefit. So I don't think, I mean, I think that was a 60s and early 70s solution, was to produce IUDs and send them to the third world.
That didn't solve the problem. Never worked.
There are other more fundamental problems. Why does a family have to have six kids to scrub, to get wood, to get water? Because they need that labor. If there wasn't the environmental problem, maybe they would. I mean, you can tie these things in lots of different ways. You see what I'm saying? I'm not sure that the population thing, again, is something we can't let swamp us. It's a massive problem. Malthus talked about it years and years ago. We have to deal with it, but it's not the only thing. We can't let it say, like Garrett Hardin produces this idea of the lifeboat ethic, that there's only so many of us you can support, so let's just chunk the other guys off, which is one answer to the problem. We can't let it be the only solution we're going to deal with, because there are other ways of dealing with it. Maybe it'll be part of the consensus and realization that there's a problem, and pollution and population becomes one of those things. It's not the bottom line. It's one.
But it is a problem.
Does anybody want me to try to stop this? Again?
I think they're beginning to smell the popcorn.
Any more questions, responses?
We can put a comma. You're going to be here for another few hours.
Yeah.
Is there any merit to the notion I've heard expressed that a wholesale or, say, even universal conversion to natural gas would solve just a tremendous amount of problems that we have now?
To me, that's the same as converting to wood. You just change one non-renewable fuel for another.
How about hydrogen?
Solar hydrogen economy is the only solution that I've seen that makes sense to me in the long term. And that's where you have solar cells which separate, you make electricity separate water into hydrogen and oxygen, and you use the natural gas pipelines to ship this sunshine-produced hydrogen around the country, and it can be used as a heating fuel, water heating fuel, a fuel for automobiles,
transportation.
Wow.
And
as we were talking about that, and also Al asked Julian and I today, or you were there, what do you think of fusion? You know, the idea of clean nuclear energy, unlimited energy. If we did that, or if we did the hydrogen thing, at this point we don't want an unlimited energy source. We need to learn to live within our means first before we can tap into something that's clean and renewable and unlimited. I mean, it's good to develop it, it's good to have it there, but that's not going to solve our problem.
It would spell the end of this cycle. That's what I think I'm scared of. It would just immediately turn the attention off the environment. If, say, we have energy, we can do anything with enough energy. And I think it's very
sad.
It's energy that has no negative.
It wouldn't solve the garbage problem.
It wouldn't solve the garbage problem. We'd still consume.
Population problem.
No, sure. It doesn't solve problems. It brings in other types. I mean, the hydrogen cycle is fairly dangerous. That's why it's not yet economically feasible a solution or alternative. Right.
The main thing has been the price of solar cells and not whether or not hydrogen.
You could split water with other electric sources.
But that wouldn't be clean though.
Hydroelectric, we talked about this the other night, but the dams in Canada run all night without producing much power. It's not being dumped because the industry turns off at night mostly. You could use that to produce enough hydrogen. You could run the whole of North America on the power produced by those hydroelectric systems already. So the technology exists, it's not like we don't have it, it's a question of will. That there is some concern about transportation of hydrogen, as I understand.
Sure, well, just like natural gas, too.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It's more dangerous, way more dangerous than natural gas. Hydrogen. I mean, it's subconscious of the people that's steadily blowing up the blimp. Mm-hmm. And it is really dangerous.
The Marina District of San Francisco.
Mercedes runs cars on hydrogen in cities. But the tank is in the center of the car, secured like a safe. It's actually a scary matter. The engine has to be absolutely tight, way tighter than traditional engines.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the natural gas issue, what I've read is that there's enough methane that leaks in the transportation of the natural gas that it offsets the value of using it. That is, the less carbon that it emits, compared to coal or to oil, it still emits some. And if you take the methane that escapes, and besides, from American point of view, we don't have a lot of natural gas. There's plenty of natural gas, I understand, in the world, but it isn't here. Those are the two arguments I've heard against use of natural gas. And then you have this argument of Kevin that we don't want really to find a lot of energy because we actually need to cut down on our civilization, which substitutes energy for people, really.
Okay, what about the economic solution then, the money problem that we talked about earlier? I just read in the Atlantic, an economist, what's his name? I can't recall his name.
Friedman?
No, that curly-headed
guy. Oh, from MIT?
Yeah, that's the one.
I can't think of
it. And he has a lot of outrageous notions, one of which is we should pay Brazil not to cut their forests. And that could be extended to a lot of these problems we've been discussing. It would mean that we would be paying and we would be lowering our standards, but this would be one approach.
Taxation and funding environmentally. I mean, just like your carbon tax. I mean, we talked
of course, if we cut down our military spending, we could pay for a lot of good things.
Well, that's true.
If we have the will to do it.